Go Pirates.
That's Dave. You'll have to ask him about that. Welcome to another edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour. I'm your host, David Johnson, here with co-host Tom Thomas and co-host Bob Pelesny. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. And again, you're listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour on WFT 90.1 FM and webcast worldwide at www.wft.com. weft.org. Okay, we're going to be having a special guest call in this afternoon about half past the hour, Aaron Hughes. He's a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and he recently just got back from Iraq. He got out of the military about a year or more ago, and he went back as a civilian this time with a union delegation from the United States for an international labor conference sponsored by the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions. So with no further ado, we have some underwriting announcements, but we can go on to some news stories. Bob, what did you bring today?
I got a story about Illinois unemployment rates, and a worsening U.S. economy pushed Illinois joblessness half a point higher in March to 9.1%, an unemployment reading the state hasn't seen since November of 1985. Illinois employers chopped 39,000 workers last month, according to the Department of Employment Security, for the sixth consecutive monthly increase in the state's unemployment rate. Illinois' unemployment tops the 8.5% nationwide level, but the state remains below the double-digit jobless levels that Michigan, at 12%, and a handful of other states are seeing. In contrast to states that rely heavily on a single industry, such as agriculture, energy, or the auto sector, and that can move disproportionately in response to industry changes, Illinois is more like a microcosm of the country, noted Professor Fred Gertz, from the Economics Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. So its labor situation tends to closely track that of the nation. It's not a pleasant thing to have unemployment go up, as it has in recent months, he acknowledged, but the rise is very much expected given that employment rates are a lagging economic yardstick. 1 year ago, unemployment in Illinois was at 6%, and outside of reeling construction sector, hard times hadn't yet arrived in Illinois. That changed with the meltdown in the financial sector last autumn, spurring a worldwide economic slump. Since then, Illinois has been losing jobs every month, with jittery employers dumping salaried employees and factory workers. And that about wraps it up, Dave.
Okay, well, I got a kind of a related story. The jobless rate in Illinois recently spiked to a 25-year high, as Bob mentioned. But some Chicago area communities are feeling a lot more pain than others. Hardest hit are working class suburbs with large numbers of minorities and immigrants. Towns like North Chicago, where 17.2% of workers, nearly one out of every six, are without jobs, according to the latest unemployment figures. And it said least affected are wealthier white-collar towns like Willamette with 4.9% out of work and Northbrook with 5.3%, according to figures compiled by the Illinois Employment Security Department. One of the greatest contrasts is in northern suburban Lake County, where Highland Park has the fourth lowest unemployment rate in the state at 5.5%, but three other cities have unemployment rates ranking them among the state's 10 worst. So the pain's not being equally felt as usual. Okay, Tom, you've got some underwriting announcements?
Yeah, the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association is... And Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice of labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. Finally, the Illinois Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And, of course, Tom's got some news stories here, and while he gets those ready, I just wanted to throw this out. This is an article from the St. Petersburg Times newspaper on how would you fix the economy? Basically, people were submitted this question. And anyway, one person wrote into the paper and said that they thought the best idea started like this. Dear Mr. President, a retirement plan that would help the economy. There are about 40 million people over 50 in the workforce currently. My solution is pay all these people over the age of 50 $1 million apiece severance with stipulations. Stipulations being one, that they leave their jobs immediately and open up 40 million new job openings. Unemployment would be fixed. Number two, they buy a new American car. 40 million cars ordered. Auto industry fixed. And number three, they either buy a house or pay off their mortgage. Housing crisis fixed. All this, and it's still cheaper than the bailout. Well, maybe a little simplistic, but I kind of like the spirit of this guy's solution. I mean, a lot better than...
That's about the best idea I've heard so far.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think all three of us could take advantage of that, couldn't we? So, of course, we're a little biased, but at any rate, I think this is a lot better plan than what they've been doing, though, handing money over to these banks with no transparency, no stipulations.
Where did the money go?
Yes. Not knowing where the money went, having no stipulations.
CEO bonuses.
Yes, it's outrageous. I mean, it's one of the biggest transfers of wealth from the poorest to the wealthiest that we've seen in this country since the beginning of the Reagan administration. I mean, so, you know, you may laugh this off as simplistic, but I'll tell you what, it's a lot better plan as far as I'm concerned than what's been done here recently and what they're proposing to do. So anyway, Tom, what do you have for us today?
Hey, the state of Ohio wants to use prisoners to replace state house janitors and groundskeepers who were laid off as a result of budget cuts brought about by the Bush recession, and one labor union is very angry about it. The Ohio Civil Service Employees Association, which represents the laid-off workers, filed a grievance April 15th to reverse the plan. The union says it is wrong to substitute inmate labor for well-paying union jobs. Ohio state government sources are saying the state house needs the inmates because it has lost 17 workers since January as a result of the aforementioned budget cuts. William Carlton, executive director of the Ohio Capitol Square Review and Advisory Board, said on Thursday that the only way to bring the employees back would be by having the federal funds reinstated. Hey, housing starts declined some 10.8% in March, a distress sign that economists say means housing construction will not make a big turnaround anytime soon. Construction of new homes and apartments fell to a seasonally adjusted rate, annual rate, of 510,000 units. The Commerce Department reported on Thursday that that was the second lowest rate in the department's records, which go back over 50 years. The decline was much more than many economists expected, and it took off some of the glow from a reported increase in February. The February figures were also revised downward in Thursday's report. Applications for building permits fell 9% in March to some 513,000 seasonally adjusted, the lowest on record. The number of newly built homes for sale has shrunk from a peak of 555,000 3 years ago to about 300,000 today. New construction has fallen in part due to the difficulty builders have getting credit, consolidations within the industry, and the fact that home prices are often actually coming in below construction cost. According to Mark Zandi of MoodysEconomy.com, housing starts are at extraordinarily low levels and we are presently at the bottom in terms of construction, and that's very hard on the home building industry. However, Zandi predicts that new construction will pick up by this time next year. But this reporter wonders how he's going to eat for that year. Okay, Deere & Company said last week it plans to combine operations that make their iconic green and yellow tractors with another unit that manufactures products like riding lawnmowers, and it will result in 200 job cuts. The job cuts involving salaried workers are expected by the end of September and will be made through voluntary separations. As of March 29th, Deere employed some 55,000 people, about half of them in salaried positions. The divisions to be combined employ a total of some 38,000 people, including 15,000 salaried workers. These cuts are only the latest at Deere & Company, which has laid off more than 1,000 workers since the beginning of this year as the world financial crises sapped demands for its products, particularly construction and forestry equipment. Deere & Company spokesman Ken Golden said the company will decide which 200 salaried jobs will have to be let go when the two operations actually start to merge. Dave?
Okay, this in here. In 2008, CEOs and other executives responsible for our current financial crisis pocketed millions of dollars from bonuses and golden parachutes, while our government spent billions of our dollars bailing out these companies. Vikram S. Bandit, I'm sorry, Vikram S. Pandit, should be Bandit, CEO of Citigroup Incorporated, received more than $38 million in total compensation in 2008, the same year his company took $59 billion in U.S. taxpayer money. To shed light on executive pay, the AFL-CIO released Executive Pay Watch 2009 that you can check out at www.unionvoice.org. In this report, we learned that CEO perks alone grew in 2008 to an average of $336,248, or nine times the median salary of a full-time worker. This comprehensive report includes much more information as well, including detailed CEO compensation data, tools that allow you to compare your pay to the CEO's, three close-up case studies focusing on 10 executive compensation practices that define a broken system that leaves the American taxpayer holding the bag. Four, the anatomy of a double standard. Executives enjoy job and retirement security while fighting the Employee Free Choice Act. Five, action for you to take. And six, boot the CEO, a satisfying online game. Outrageous executive pay is a symptom of a disease that has infected our entire economic system. So go to the AFL-CIO website at www.unionvoice.org. Okay, we're going to hear a little Jim Hightower here, and then Workers Independent News, and then we'll be right back.
Obama and his financial team keep telling us that their Wall Street bailout is all about Main Street, not about the financial elites. I'm sure you're deeply honored to be at the center of their thoughts, but I can't help noticing that all of the money is actually going to those who reside in Wall Street's zip code, not ours. One reason for this might be Larry. Larry Summers is Obama's lead architect for this multi-trillion-dollar bailout. Everyone says he's brilliant, which I don't doubt. But brilliant for whom? You see, Larry doesn't live in our zip code either. He hails from 10005, the lucrative Wall Street zip code, where he has long put his brilliance to work for those elites. As a Treasury official under Bill Clinton, he was an ardent champion of the deregulation scams that subsequently enriched the already rich before crashing our economy, and he's been a welcome insider ever since. Indeed, last year, even as the financial industry was collapsing under the weight of its deregulated greed, Larry was drawing $2.7 million in speaking fees from Wall Street firms and was paid $5 million to be a part-time advisor for one of Wall Street's largest hedge funds, where he specialized in esoteric trading strategies that, guess what, enriched the rich, usually at our expense. Larry says he sees no conflict in such coziness. Au contraire, now that he's shaping bailout policy for Obama, he says his Wall Street experience and connections give him special insight. I have a better sense of how market participants sort of think and react to things, he explains. This is Jim Hightower saying, that is special, isn't it? Maybe the financial giants are getting all the money because, well, because Larry thinks like them. Here's my question. Shouldn't Barack Obama find at least one bailout advisor who thinks like we do instead of like Wall Street bankers think?
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Son.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. On the Employee Free Choice Act labor law reform, Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter is either ignorant or lying when he says,
I could not support it when it eliminated the secret ballot. If they get 50% plus one, the union is recognized, and there is not the current procedure of having a secret ballot election.
Specter is dead wrong. The National Labor Relations Act says when 30% of workers file with the board, an election shall be called when the workers decide to file. If the Employee Free Choice Act passes, workers could still do that. What changes is that workers could choose instead to get 50% plus one to sign union cards, and then the employer would be required by the law to respect the workers' choice to form a union. Senator Arlen Specter is either ignorant or lying when he says this about the Employee Free Choice Act.
The Choice Act has an entirely new procedure where you collect cards.
Specter is dead wrong again. Union cards aren't newly created by this reform. They're used under current law, but only if the employer chooses to allow them. The Employee Free Choice Act lets workers choose to use union cards to organize unions. It may be possible that Specter isn't lying or ignorant here. Maybe he's just singing the tune paid for by the more than $230,000 in campaign cash he took from the union-busting law firm Blank Rome, LLP. 100 workers for a Hewlett-Packard subsidiary in France have released five managers after they were notified that FM Logistics would soon be introducing a proposal to save jobs. The company had originally announced plans to lay off 483 workers in June, triggering the worker reaction to take their managers hostage for 10 hours. It's an ongoing tactic by French workers. Suicide rates for debt-ridden Indian farmers are skyrocketing. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 1,500 farmers in India have committed suicide over the past year as they face a massive and ongoing drought, which is driving them into debt. According to Down to Earth magazine, the water level in the Indian region of Chhattisgarh has dropped by more than 200 feet over only a handful of years. Without water, the farmers have no crops to pay off lenders. According to the Organic Farming Association of India, nearly 10,000 farmers across the country who were facing increasing debts committed suicide in the last decade. The government has stepped in to try and help the debt-ridden farmers, offering to waive farmer loans. Here is today's economic report.
The month of March saw New York State's unemployment rate hold steady at 7.8%, even though 33,000 private sector positions were lost. Overall, the state has seen a decline of 176,100 jobs in the private sector since August of 2008. New York City's unemployment rate was also steady in March, staying at 8.1%. In March of 2008, the city's unemployment rate was 4.6%.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Cultural corner of the Illinois Labor Hour with Tom Thomas's poem for the day, War No More.
What is the worst disease of all the sicknesses our earth has known? Why can't we realize the call to war comes from the devil's throne? The Bushites brought the towers down with assistance from the Mossad so they could take us into war to kill those Arabs for some god. But the Arabs they are killing are the innocent and the poor, and the graveyards they are filling prove the injustices of war. That curse from hell is on our land, as it has been for many years, brought to us by fascism's hand and drowning us in mother's tears. When will we stand to stop the hate and misery brought us by war? Why can't we make our nation great as it once was so long before? Refuse to send your children to a foreign land where they will die. Remove the fascists from our crew, the ones who can do naught but lie. The first and most important thing that need be done to stop all war is that together we all sing, no more, no more, no more, no more. War No More was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois, April 16, 2009. It was first recited live April 18, 2009 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Yes, and the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers, as usual. Tom, a very good poem there. So we got a few public service announcements here. The Central Illinois Social Forum will be held Saturday, May 2nd, at the downtown Urbana Post Office Building, IMC, at 202 South Broadway. Food and entertainment. The event starts at 12:30, and it'll be going to as late as midnight, possibly. But there'll be food, entertainment, and a series of workshops about the how to cope with the current economic crisis, include unemployment, job creation, real people telling their stories, urban community building, poor people's movement and anti-eviction action, community gardens, and food nut bombs. We cannot rely on the government or other powers that be to rescue us in these times of crisis. We must come together as a community and help ourselves help one another. We need you. For more information, you can contact, you got a contact phone number here at 328-3037. That's 328-3037. That's the Central Illinois Social Forum, Saturday, May 2nd, starting at 12:30 p.m.
For the second time this spring, recreational boating has been restricted on the Middle Fork of the Vermilion River in Vermilion County. Illinois Department of Natural Resources spokeswoman Stacy Soleno said conditions on the river are dangerous enough to restrict recreational boating from the north boundary of the Middle Fork Fish and Wildlife Area to the south boundary of Kickapoo State Park. Soleno said all recreational watercraft will be restricted until further notice. Soleno also said the department is monitoring the situation and expects to remove the restrictions when conditions improve. That's for all my fishermen friend out there.
Okay, well, thank you, Tom. And we're going to be hearing from our call-in guest here in about 4 minutes or so. And in the meantime, we'll listen to a little music. This is Blues Over Baghdad.
All I got. Blues over Baghdad, forget me not. Remember me because I fought. Bombs exploding throughout the night, bodies strewn left and right. When hungry guns and short tempers meet, man's inhumanity is man's defeat. When both sides of war awaken, we count the living and salute those taken.
Off to fight some more land. in your arms again. Don't wanna shoot nobody, baby. I wanna make sweet love to you. Don't wanna shoot nobody, baby. I wanna make sweet love to you. I'm going out everywhere. Man, I don't know what to do. Don't wanna fight ya. Don't wanna fight no more.
WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, I was looking for David.
Yes, Aaron. You're on the air right now. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on. I'm honored to be here.
Oh, our pleasure. Well, listen, we're talking to Aaron Hughes, and I'll just have you introduce yourself, Aaron.
Like you said, my name's Aaron Hughes. I'm a veteran. I'm a part of an organization called Iraq Veterans Against the War. It's a national organization of around 2,000 veterans, 56 chapters across the United States, a couple active duty chapters that stand on a couple basic principles, full withdrawal, all occupying forces out of Iraq, reparations for the Iraqi people, VA benefits for all the returning veterans, and we also have a position against the occupation of Afghanistan, and we support war resistors. I'm actually a native of Champaign-Urbana. I went to college down there for a couple of years, so got my bachelor's there.
Okay, and how long were you in the military?
I served in the military from 2000 to 2006. I served in the Illinois Army National Guard, and I joined up specifically to serve my community. When I was getting out of high school, I didn't really know what I was going to do with my life, and I had this kind of longing to want to serve my country and serve my community. And my family, being from Louisiana, had been through a couple hurricanes, and when I was a little kid, we had been through a tornado in central Illinois, and I just remember that the National Guard had come out and helped, and my National Guard recruiter talked a lot about, providing humanitarian relief and supporting the local communities throughout Illinois, and I thought, like, this would be a really great opportunity, and he said, hey, you know, you can get money for college, and he picked me up in a red Camaro and took me out to Burger King, so I was really excited to join the Illinois Army National Guard back in 2000, before 9/11 and before President Bush. So it was kind of a different political atmosphere at the time. And I stayed in until 2006. So, and during that time, I had one deployment when I was a junior at the University of Illinois. I got called up in January of 2003 and got activated for quote-unquote Operation Iraqi Freedom, where I hauled the division's supplies in and out of Iraq from the ports in Kuwait up into the different forward operating bases, the FOBs. So that was kind of my lineage of being in the military.
Okay. Now, you just recently returned to Iraq. Was it about a month ago?
Yeah. We left on March 10th, and I flew back to Iraq and participate in the first international labor conference in Erbil, Iraq, and the reason why this was such a big deal for me was my experience over when I was deployed was one of this constant process of dehumanizing the Iraqi people and myself. The first time I crossed the border, you lock and load, and you put on your flak vest, you put your Kevlar on, and you drive up to the border, and there's this big concrete barrier that says, beware of children in roadway, 1,000 meters, like they're, deer or something. And, that as soon as you cross the border, it's clear that, there's little kids all over the place willing to jump on semi-trucks to get food and water. And, we never stopped to help them, and our mission was never to ever to help the Iraqi people. In fact, one time I tried to actually give an older woman some water, and I got reprimanded for it. And this kind of carried on for, I was deployed for a year and 3 months and 7 days. So you know, the first day I crossed the border, I thought, oh, well, this is, you know, these are the people that we're going to help. I got there in April right after President Bush said the war was, the mission was complete, and I thought we were going to help rebuild the country. And
mission accomplished, right?
Yeah, mission accomplished.
And now, six years later?
Mission.
Yeah. Established some type of democracy, quote unquote. And what ended up happening was we didn't do anything of the sorts. In fact, we ended up hauling a lot of supplies for contractors while at the same time the Iraqi people were suffering so much. The power was never turned back. You know, we never helped actually rebuild any of the infrastructure unless it had to do with our own infrastructure. Like, I remember there was a Burger King in the Baghdad, in Bayap, it's Baghdad International Airport, the base for the soldiers there before there was water for the Iraqis and the surrounding areas. And at the same time, people were profiting. And
you said so there was a Burger King there?
Yeah, there's Burger King and all type of, it's like the corporate store. All of the major bases have these huge Walmarts, and they have different...
Oh, boy. A little piece of America in the middle of the occupation, huh?
Yes. Bring some comfort, and actually, soldiers spend a lot of money there. You can buy your, you know, Harley Davidson there and have it waiting for you when you get home.
Oh, boy. So, okay, now... Going back here with the labor delegation from the U.S., two-part question. One, I'd like to, our listeners to know which unions participated in this, and two, what it felt for you personally returning. I mean, of course, you got out of the military a couple of years ago, and this was your first time back as a civilian.
Well, it was a real honor. Iraq Veterans Against the War was the only non labor organization to go from the U.S. delegation. There was six individuals in the U.S. delegation. There was Michael Zweig from United University's professors and the AFT, which is the American Federation of Teachers. And then there was Bill Shortell, who's the president of the Central Connecticut Labor Council. And also he's a part of the International Association of Machinists, the Machinist Union. There was Jim Norris, who's the president of the United Steelworkers, Local 675, which is the oil workers in California. He has quite a few oil refineries that he's the president of. And then there was Michael Eisenshare, who's the national coordinator for U.S. labor against the war. And so, and then besides myself from Iraq Veterans Against the War, there was T.J. Bonomo, who is a former Army intelligence officer who was forced to resign from the military after writing quite a few letters about his frustrations in regards specifically around how the U.S. occupation wasn't going to be able to establish any type of democracy because of worker rights. And so it was a pretty humbling experience to go back with these individuals. And to be really honest, I was extremely anxious to go back to this country. And, you know, I wasn't sure what type of sentiment there would be to an American former soldier that served in the country and had participated in oppressing their families. I mean, I remember quite a few times pointing my weapon and just really just different situations that aren't, I don't know, maybe the best. And it was pretty humbling to be welcomed so with so much open arms and to be received. And I actually, when IVAW had an opportunity to present, I started my presentation by apologizing for being in their country and oppressing their communities and their families and pointing my weapon their communities and their families, and for that I'm sorry. But you know, I also said that you know, I'm not here for forgiveness. I'm here to take responsibility, and responsibility is something I have to take, and that's what Iraq Veterans Against the War is trying to do. We've seen the corporate pillaging and the destruction of Iraq firsthand, and we want to be able to support the workers and not help them in like some type of paternal sense, but actually stand aligned with them so they can rebuild their country as they see.
Are there actual organized labor unions now functioning in the country of Iraq?
Yes, there are. There's over the last 4 years, they've exploded, and there's over 200 labor unions that, or 200 representatives that came to the conference from out Iraq, over, from 15 of the province, 15 of the 18
great
provinces. There was workers from the oil and gas industry, which is the largest union in Iraq. They have over 25,000 members and the strongest union. They also had representatives from the port union, electrical generation and distribution industry, the construction industry, the public sector, transportation, communication, education, railroads, service and health care industries, the machinists, the metalworking sector. There's also the petrochemical industry, the civil engineers, writers and journalists, food and oil workers, the tailors, and student unions as well. All were there at the conference, and it was an amazing, overwhelming thing because these workers are still underneath Saddam's law, Paul Bremer, when the provisional government and now the new government in Iraq. Despite the fact that workers' rights is a part of their constitution, they've carried over Law 150 from 1987 that Saddam put into act that basically permits all organizing in the public sector, and 70% of the workforce in Iraq is in the public sector. And in the private sector, you had to have 50 workers or more on a work site to form a union or to have legal arbitration. And most work sites were smaller than that, and that was specifically
like
designed
maybe a dozen
the way
workers
that
workers instead of 50.
Right.
Well, that's amazing to me because I heard that we went there to bring democracy to Iraq and overthrow a dictator. And you're telling me that they carried on a law from the Saddam Hussein era as far as outlawing unions in the public sector and putting restrictions on private sector union formation?
Yeah, and that's a lot of why I'm in Iraq, Veterans Against the War. You know, I went over there with these great ideals to help rebuild a country, to provide humanitarian relief, and instead I ended up oppressing a people, and we never established any form of democracy, and instead we're breeding the different divisions that are happening in the country. I mean, Hunt Oil Company, U.S. Oil Company, just made a deal with the Kurdish regional government, and that oil deal then is subverting the national government because it's technically Iraq's oil, and like just we're breeding the way the U.S. is operating, the U.S. and the way the U.S. corporations are operating, which are profiting so much off the situation over there. I mean, I find that sickening when corporations are able to profit and people are dying and
it's a corporate
suffering
war.
The way they are. So.
Yes, and also I understand that, you know, I heard you speak here in Champaign a couple weeks ago when you came down for the first Sunday People's Potluck that's always held at the IMC in Urbana. One thing you said that really shocked me was about how, as part of your duties when you were in Iraq as a soldier, that you actually guarded workers that were imported from Bangladesh and other parts of Asia basically to work on various projects, even though there were plenty of Iraqi workers that were available, but that they could pay these workers from Bangladesh and other places in Southeast Asia cheaper than the Iraqis. And your guard was your job was to guard these workers. They were almost like slaves.
Yeah. You know, 70% of the workforce in Iraq is unemployed, and I think this is why these unions are so important. The oil workers, when KBR, a subsidiary of Halliburton, brought in these third country nationals to begin to work on the oil fields in the South, and it is slave labor. I mean, when I did these missions, I mean, it was called third country national duty, TCN, and they'd work 16-hour days, and we would have 12-hour shifts, and we'd stand over them, and I carried an M249 squad automatic weapon. I would make sure that they didn't do anything that they weren't supposed to do, but I mean, these people had nothing, and there was no threat. I mean, there was no threat coming from them, and they were the ones that were actually building up the entire infrastructure of the U.S. Bases, of the U.S. Occupation. And so, you know, these people that have built up these massive bases, it's all through these contracts underneath contracts underneath contracts where all these major corporations are profiting, or someone that knows someone is profiting. And these people are brought in with slave labor. Their passports are taken at the border, and they don't know this when they come over. And then they're put in these work camps. And where are they supposed to go? They can't just leave. You know, they can't just go home. They got flown there. They're not just going to walk out into a war zone.
Yeah, and also I imagine there's checkpoints, aren't there? People have to have papers.
Yeah, I mean they can't just. I mean the bases are very secure. I mean,
mm-hmm.
One of my fellow veterans actually told me that they stay in one specific section of the camp, and said that because of the black market had risen so much between soldiers and third country nationals, that there was actually a raid. I mean, this is how kind of like messed up the situation gets over there in regards to the way that the U.S. is using and abusing these other workers. And there was a raid on their part of the camp, and they basically took everything that belonged to these people. And I mean, that's just, you know, that breeds, you know, you bring these workers into this area like they did in southern Iraq and Basra, and the oil workers have to then go on a massive strike and do a massive demonstrations to force them out, to say, no, we want jobs, we want to rebuild our country. And they know that it's not the workers that are their enemy, but they know it's the corporations that are so focused on privatization. I mean, the conference came out with a few resolutions, and one was specifically against privatization because they're seeing exactly how it's affecting their country and how it's not helping the working class or the reconstruction of their country that we've participated in destroying.
You know, what really amazes me is that, you know, the U.S. military comes in, they overthrow the Saddam government, they allow, the only law that they allowed to carry over from the Saddam era was this anti-union law, and despite the law and all these armed military everywhere, the Iraqi workers openly defied it and formed unions anyway. I mean, almost from the very beginning. You've heard stories about that and probably maybe saw things?
Amazing stories. I mean, the electrical workers, I think, had the most humbling story I've heard. The U.S. military had taken over one of the power plants as part of a base in near the area of Babel, and the workers were still trying to keep their power plant and maintain it, and they were trying to bring different equipment into their plant, and the U.S. said, oh no, you can't bring this in here because it's a security threat. And so the workers were like, we have to bring this in here to maintain the power plant. And you know, the power plants throughout the country have been in so much disarray over the last, and they didn't want their power plant to fall into the same situation. And so they started going on these massive strikes and doing these massive demonstrations in front of this military base. And the government called down the head of the union and said, you guys, it's worse than yourself. You're frustrating the U.S. military. They're going to come after you, you know, like you're on yourself. And they said, no, we're not going to stop because this is about our communities and our people and keeping the power on for our people. And they striking, and eventually the U.S. military was actually forced off of the power plant, and the workers were able to go back into the power plant and maintain it. So it's pretty amazing story.
Yeah, very amazing, very courageous, considering everything that was against them. I also heard stories that many of the union offices had been raided by U.S. military, where they vandalized the offices, arrested union leaders, and going back some years, but including up to today, have been freezing their assets, seizing other assets. And that there's even, for a while there, labor leaders were being targeted by, being assassinated, basically, by groups, quote-unquote, unknown.
Yeah, that's a documented history in regards to what's happened in the way that the U.S. military has basically oppressed these workers and their ability to organize. And in 2006 was when there was a law passed that froze all their assets, and their assets were... They're not only dealing with the occupation, they're dealing with their government, they're dealing with the different militias in their local areas. I mean, they have all these odds against them, and yet they still have hope, and they still have goals, and they're really clear what they want. They want their workers' rights underneath the ILO. They want to rebuild their country. They want a non-ethnic, non-religious... non-ethnic, non-sectarian government. And I mean, I think that that has to be applauded when we're not hearing this. You know, we're not hearing about these moments of amazing direct, non-violent direct action that these workers are taking to rebuild their communities and their country. And instead, we hear about, you know, the very violent extremists, and we're not hearing about the working class of the country and how they're really focused on rebuilding their country and democracy.
These are just amazing stories, and I imagine this was quite an emotional experience for you. I mean, going back, you know, as a civilian as opposed to a soldier, and meeting all these, you know, really brave and wonderful, you know, Iraqi trade unionists and stuff. And do you? We're going to be. We got just a few minutes left here, Aaron. Some parting words to leave us with here.
Yeah, I can just say I think the most important thing coming out for me is that how humbling the whole experience was. You know, when I was deployed, the Iraqis were always on the other side of my weapon, and I always kept them at a distance, and we always called them Hajis, and in a derogatory way, and dehumanized them, and this opportunity to commune with them, to sit and have conversations with them, to have tea with them, for them to share, you know, to share a really just a beautiful experience of like how of their struggle. And I mean, it just, it's really extremely humbling. And after our talk, a man stood up in the back of the conference, and he was clearly speaking in Arabic, and we had to wait for the translation. He started walking up on stage, and I was extremely anxious. My palms are sweating, and I just thought, you know, this is what I deserve, whatever, you know, like, I don't know, I thought he was going to come up and yell at us, or, you know, and that's not, he came up on stage and he said, I just want to give these two gentlemen a hug. And, I mean, I think that's the heart of the Iraqi people right there. And that willingness to overcome, you know, even the destruction that I've done to their country and for humanity. And I really was humbled by that and really appreciated that. And I hope that people, you know, follow the situation with the Iraqi workers and check out U.S. Labor Against the Law, Up Against the War. It's U.S. law. That's why I keep saying that. U.S. Labor Against the War website, because they need support. This conference is really expensive for them. And they're really clear with what they need. And the biggest thing that's coming up on their plate is the oil and gas law. And currently, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has been pushing for that, even underneath a Democratic position. And I think that really needs to get reevaluated and re-looked at before the U.S. pushes any oil and gas law in Iraq, because it needs to be for the Iraqi people. It needs to be for the Iraqi workers.
Yeah. Hey, Aaron, my name's Bill. And
hey, Bill.
Anyway, that's very, very affecting, you know, touching statement you made there. And sounds like you got along better there than I did at the Tea Party Wednesday. So, but anyway, you mentioned U.S. law. Would that be www.uslaw.org?
It's www.uslaboragainstwar.org.
Oh, thank you.
All is one word.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Aaron. This was really inspiring and very, very informative.
Well, thank you very much.
And hopefully we'll cross paths again sometime in the future.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
I'm a fire team leader at the time, trying to get my Marines to cover so we can at least get out of the kill zone and be able to return fire and survive this. One of my very good friends, Paul, winds up getting shot. He's bleeding out and he's dying terribly.
I have so much more to say, my brother. Can you hear me? A fool is left to live as the brave ones fall. I swear if I were able, I would have done the same for you. But now you're gone and I wish I.
Well, folks, that was Queensryche, a pretty good old arena rock and metal band from the 80s, and it's a new song by them called If I Were King, off their new album, American Soldier. We played that for Aaron. And I was reading about it. It's already in the stores. It's been in there since March 31st, and it's a concept album. Queensryche has done many of those, including titles like Operation Mindcrime. And they described it as looking at the world or at the war from the soldier's point of view.
That's great, Bill. Now, we've got about 5 minutes left in the show here, and I really want to – I think the listeners would really like listening to this experience you had this last week.
Okay. It's the war at home, folks, the culture war. And this time it was being expressed in tax protest. The Tea Parties, which they had backwards because the original Tea Party was in response to a corporate tax cut for the East India Tea Company, which was wiping out the American independent tea people. Anyway, so I went to the Tea Party Wednesday there at Westside Park, and I had some signs made, and I drove around and looked, and I thought, well, I don't know if I want to get into that, so I'll just take some pictures. So I got out, and I had my friend Shelley Mazar with me, or Masser, excuse me. And anyway, Shelley went down to the Walnut Street Tea store, great place, get a new coffee pot because she didn't want to be kind of exposed to all that. And I was taking pictures, working my way through the crowd, actually having a fairly good time because these people, they're like my parents and a lot of the people out in BMET, where I'm from, you know, out there in Pike County. And anyway, I was working my way through the crowd, got towards the back of it, and I hear somebody talking loudly about how we're going to pay for schools and such, and that was Shelley, and then people started arguing with her, and then a TV station decided that she was going to be the voice of opposition, and I wouldn't go on camera myself, and they interviewed her, and while she was being interviewed, I ran into a guy that was wearing one of those Homeland Security since 1492 t-shirts. And we didn't recognize each other because we hadn't worked together for about 10 years, but he was a laborer, and I think he's had an injury and had to drop out. Well, anyway, I can't remember what nation he's from, but they're on a reservation in Oklahoma. And his people had told him to go to that tea party because they're keeping this movement under observation because they're worried about, you know, hate crimes and such being generated from it, or a renewed militia movement that, you know, gets out of hand, I guess. So anyway, that was interesting meeting him there. And at one point, I think I was talking to a Daily Illini reporter explaining Kevin Phillips' book, The Politics of Rich and Poor, and how Ronald Reagan caused one of the greatest redistributions of wealth. You know, these right-wingers do hate redistributing wealth unless it's going
wealth.
Yeah, unless it's going upwards, unless it's our wealth. And then I turn around, and there was some guy just screaming at Shelley and calling her all kinds of liberal B word and throwing F bombs all over the place. And so I went over there and I go, was this any way for a Christian gentleman to act? And then he just got all up in my face. I mean, he was actually probably within 2 inches of my face, well within the salt range. And he just kept yelling all this stuff at me. And I would just make kind of smart aleck remarks back and just stand there. And then it finally come on, hit me, come on and hit me, and all that. And one of their organizers came by, and I wonder if they would be community organizers, you know, kind of led the guy away. And then, anyway, we were heading out of the park, and Shelley got stopped by one of the TV stations videotaped this whole confrontation with this guy, too.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe I should try to get a copy of it. But they Shelley was being interviewed again, and I kind of looked around. I saw this kind of really beefy, big guy. Like he had a shaved head, looked like he might have been a cop or security guard or some kind of thing, you know.
Or Nazi.
Thug. And anyway, we walked back to the car. It's about a block away. And I put my camera in, back in its bag and put it in the car. And then I looked and I see this guy. He had followed us and was about two cars behind us. And then I turned to look at him. And then he turns and pulls out a piece of paper and starts writing on it, which I assume would be like he was writing down my license plate number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I hope it was just some little bit of intimidation, because if those plates are run, then they know everything about me, including my Social Security number.
And address and all that. You know, that's really discouraging because, you know, in this point in time, I mean, we really, the people in this country, really need to get unified and try to take back our government. And, you know, I hope that not everybody at that event was like that. I'm hoping that a lot of people went there to, you know, trying to find an outlet for some legitimate, you know, complaints. But
Actually, you know, I could have talked to people and said, oh, I'm in all agreement with you about the bailout. But this wasn't really – the bailout kind of spurred it, but this was really just anti-income tax.
Oh, I see.
That was the whole thing. And anti-Democrat and anti-Obama, which – you know, in some ways, I don't mind that much.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have to say, listening to Tom Hartman's show this week, and that's tomhartman.com, and he has URLs and all the variations of that, so just type it in. And Mike Malloy, which would be mikemalloy.com, a lot of people were calling in and saying, like one woman said she talked to an elderly woman, and this is what's really interesting, is if you look at the crowd, you know at least half of them are on Social Security or SSI.
Okay.
You know, they're that old or they're that crippled.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
Yeah, they're saying get the government off our backs and do away with government. That's real consistent, yeah.
But really quick, because Carl's
yes, indeed.
Standing here. Anyway, it's a tradition. people, well, like one woman called in to Tom Hartman and said that she saw an older woman wearing this anti-Obama button, and she started talking to her, and the woman goes, oh, I really like Obama. They just told me to put this button on.
Oh, wow. Bill, thanks for sharing that with us. And yes, Bar Diverse is coming up. We're going to finish off here with a little James McMurtry, and then Carl will be on the air, and we'll see you next week. This has been the Illinois World Labor Hour. Thank you.
Coming, mercy me. Three wise men in SUV. Corporate logo on the side. Air conditioned, quiet ride. That thing don't run on French fry grease. That thing don't run on love and peace. Takes gasoline, make that thing go. Now bring your hands up nice and slow. Take us to the land.